"This last week or two," he went on, "I've been cutting all my committees and all my girls. You can't imagine what a hullabaloo they've been making about it at the college. Still, it's been worth it, I think. The effects..." He hesitated. "Well, they're odd. They're very odd." A physical shortcoming could produce a kind of mental excess. The process, it seemed, was reversible. Mental excess could produce, for its own purposes, the voluntary blindness and deafness of deliberate solitude, the artificial impotence of asceticism. The rest of the short flight was accomplished in silence. When they had arrived and were comfortably stretched out on the pneumatic sofas in Bernard's room, Helmholtz began again. Speaking very slowly, "Did you ever feel," he asked, "as though you had something inside you that was only waiting for you to give it a chance to come out? Some sort of extra power that you aren't using, you know, like all the water that goes down the falls instead of through the turbines?" He looked at Bernard questioningly. "You mean all the emotions one might be feeling if things were different?" Helmholtz shook his head. "Not quite. I'm thinking of a queer feeling I sometimes get, a feeling that I've got something important to say and the power to say it, only I don't know what it is, and I can't make any use of the power. If there was some different way of writing, or else something else to write about..." He was silent. Then, "You see," he went on at last, "I'm pretty good at inventing phrases, you know, the sort of words that suddenly make you jump, almost as though you'd sat on a pin. They seem so new and exciting, even though they're about something hypnopedically obvious. But that doesn't seem enough. It's not enough for the phrases to be good. What you make with them ought to be good, too."
"But your things are good, Helmholtz."
"Oh, as far as they go..." Helmholtz shrugged his shoulders. "But they go such a little way. They aren't important enough, somehow. I feel I could do something much more important. Yes, and much more intense, more violent. But what? What is there more important to say? And how can one be violent about the sort of things one's expected to write about? Words can be like X-rays, if you use them properly. They'll go through anything. You read, and you're pierced. That's one of the things I try to teach my students, how to write piercingly. But what on earth's the good of being pierced by an article about a community sing or the latest improvements in scent organs? Besides, can you make words really piercing, you know, like the very hardest X-rays, when you're writing about that sort of thing? Can you say something about nothing? That's what it finally boils down to. I try and I try..."
"Hush,"
said Bernard suddenly, and lifted a warning finger. They listened.
"I believe there's somebody at the door,"
he whispered. Helmholtz got up, tiptoed across the room, and with a sharp, quick movement, flung the door wide open. There was, of course, nobody there.
"I'm sorry," said Bernard, feeling and looking uncomfortably foolish. "I suppose I've got things on my nerves a bit. When people are suspicious with you, you start being suspicious with them."
He passed his hand across his eyes. He sighed. His voice became plaintive. He was justifying himself.
"If you knew what I had to put up with recently," he said almost tearfully,
and the uprush of his self-pity was like a fountain suddenly released.
"If you only knew..."
Helmholtz Watson listened with a certain sense of discomfort. "Poor little Bernard," he said to himself. But at the same time, he felt rather ashamed for his friend. He wished Bernard would show a little more pride. Chapter 5. By 8 o'clock, the light was failing. The loudspeakers in the tower of the Stoke Poges clubhouse began, in a more than human tenor, to announce the closing of the courses. Lenina and Henry abandoned their game and walked back towards the club.
From the grounds of the Internal and External Secretion Trust came the lowing of those thousands of cattle which provided, with their hormones and their milk, the raw materials for the great factory at Farnham Royal. The incessant buzzing of helicopters filled the twilight. Every 2.5 minutes a bell and the screech of whistles announced the departure of one of the light monorail trains which carried the lower caste golfers back from their separate course to the metropolis. Lenina and Henry climbed into their machine and started off. At 800 feet, Henry slowed down the helicopter screws, and they hung for a minute or two poised above the fading landscape. The forest of Burnham Beeches stretched like a great pool of darkness towards the bright shore of the western sky. Crimson at the horizon, the last of the sunset faded through orange, upwards into yellow, and a pale, watery green. Northwards, beyond and above the trees, the Internal and External Secretions Factory glared with a fierce electric brilliance from every window of its 20 stories. Beneath them lay the buildings of the golf club, the huge lower-caste barracks, and on the other side of a dividing wall, the smaller houses reserved for Alpha and Beta members. The approaches to the monorail station were black with the ant-like pollution of lower-caste activity. From under the glass vault, a lighted train shot out into the open. Following its southeasterly course across the dark plain, their eyes were drawn to the majestic buildings of the Slough Crematorium. For the safety of night-flying planes, its 4 tall chimneys were floodlighted and tipped with crimson danger signals. It was a landmark.
"Why do the smokestacks have those things like balconies around them?" inquired Lenina.
"Phosphorus recovery," explained Henry telegraphically. "On their way up the chimney, the gases go through 4 separate treatments. P2O5 used to go right out of circulation every time they cremated someone. Now they recover over 98% of it, more than 1.5 kilos per adult corpse, which makes the best part of 400 tons of phosphorus every year from England alone." Henry spoke with a happy pride, rejoicing wholeheartedly in the achievement, as though it had been his own. "Fine to think we can go on being socially useful, even after we're dead, making plants grow." Lenina, meanwhile, had turned her eyes away and was looking perpendicularly downward at the monorail station.
"Fine," she agreed, "but queer that alphas and betas won't make any more plants grow than those nasty little gammas and deltas and epsilons down there."
"All men are physico-chemically equal," said Henry sententiously. "Besides, even epsilons perform indispensable services."
"Even an epsilon."
Lenina suddenly remembered an occasion when, as a little girl at school, she had woken up in the middle of the night and become aware for the first time of the whispering that had haunted all her sleeps. She saw again the beam of moonlight, the row of small white beds, heard once more the soft, soft voice that said — the words were there, unforgotten, unforgettable after so many night-long repetitions — "Everyone works for everyone else. We can't do without anyone. Even epsilons are useful. We couldn't do without epsilons. Everyone works for everyone else. We can't do without anyone." Lenina remembered her first shock of fear and surprise, her speculations through half a wakeful hour, and then, under the influence of those endless repetitions, the gradual soothing of her mind, the soothing, the smoothing, the stealthy creeping of sleep.
"I suppose epsilons don't really mind being epsilons," she said aloud.
"Of course they don't. How can they? They don't know what it's like being anything else. We'd mind, of course, but then we've been differently conditioned. Besides, we start with a different heredity."
"I'm glad I'm not an epsilon," said Lenina with conviction.
"And if you were an epsilon," said Henry, "your conditioning would have made you no less thankful that you weren't a beta or an alpha." He put his forward propeller into gear and headed the machine towards London. Behind them, in the west, the crimson and orange were almost faded. A dark bank of cloud had crept into the zenith.
As they flew over the crematorium, the plane shot upwards on the column of hot air rising from the chimneys, only to fall as suddenly when it passed into the descending chill beyond. "What a marvellous switchback!" Lenina laughed delightedly. But Henry's tone was almost for a moment melancholy. "Do you know what that switchback was?" he said. "It was some human being, finally and definitely disappearing, going up in a squirt of hot gas. It would be curious to know who it was, a man or a woman, an alpha or an epsilon." He sighed. Then, in a resolutely cheerful voice, "Anyhow," he concluded, "there's one thing we can be certain of. Whoever he may have been, he was happy when he was alive. Everybody's happy now."
"Yes, everybody's happy now," echoed Lenina.
They had heard the words repeated 150 times every night for 12 years. Landing on the roof of Henry's 40-story apartment house in Westminster, they went straight down to the dining hall. There, in a loud and cheerful company, they ate an excellent meal. Soma was served with the coffee. Lenina took 2 half-gram tablets and Henry 3. At 9:20, they walked across the street to the newly opened Westminster Abbey Cabaret. It was a night almost without clouds, moonless and starry. But of this, on the whole, depressing fact, Lenina and Henry were fortunately unaware. The electric sky signs effectively shut off the outer darkness. "Calvin Stopes and his 16 saxophonists!" From the façade of the new abbey the giant letters invitingly glared, "London's finest scent and colour organ. All the latest synthetic music!" They entered. The air seemed hot and somehow breathless with the scent of ambergris and sandalwood. On the domed ceiling of the hall, the colour organ had momentarily painted a tropical sunset. The 16 saxophonists were playing an old favourite. "There ain't no bottle in all the world like that dear little bottle of mine." 400 couples were five-stepping around the polished floor. Lennon and Henry were soon the 401st. The saxophones wailed like melodious cats under the moon, moaned in the alto and tenor registers as though the little death were upon them. Rich with a wealth of harmonics, their tremulous chorus mounted towards a climax, louder and even louder, until at last, with a wave of his hand, the conductor let loose the final shattering note of ether music and blew the 16 merely human blowers clean out of existence. Thunder in A-flat major. And then, in all but silence, in all but darkness, there followed a gradual detergescence, a diminuendo sliding gradually through quarter tones down to a faintly whispered dominant chord that lingered on, while the 5-4 rhythm still pulsed below, charging the darkened seconds with an intense expectancy. And at last, expectancy was fulfilled. There was a sudden explosive sunrise, and simultaneously the 16 burst into song. "Bottle of mine, it's you I've always wanted. Bottle of mine, why was I ever decanted? Skies are blue inside of you, the weather's always fine, for there ain't no bottle in all the world like that dear little bottle of mine." Five-stepping with the other 400 round and round Westminster Abbey, Lenina and Henry were yet dancing in another world. The warm, richly coloured, the infinitely friendly world of Soma Holiday. How kind, how good-looking, how delightfully amusing everyone was. "Bottle of mine, it's you I've always wanted." But Lenina and Henry had what they wanted. They were inside, here and now, safely inside with the fine weather, the perennially blue sky. And when, exhausted, the 16 had laid by their saxophones, and the synthetic music apparatus was producing the very latest in slow Malthusian blues, They might have been twin embryos, gently rocking together on the waves of a bottled ocean of blood surrogate.
"Good night, dear friends. Good night, dear friends."
The loudspeakers veiled their commands in a genial and musical politeness.
"Good night, dear friends."
Obediently, with all the others, Lenina and Henry left the building. The depressing stars had travelled quite some way across the heavens, but though the separating screen of the sky signs had now to a great extent dissolved, the two young people still retained their happy ignorance of the night. Swallowed half an hour before closing time, that second dose of soma had raised a quite impenetrable wall between the actual universe and their minds. Bottled, they crossed the street. Bottled, they took the lift up to Henry's room on the 28th floor, and yet, bottled as she was, and in spite of that second gram of soma, Lenina did not forget to take all the contraceptive precautions prescribed by the regulations. Years of intensive hypnopedia, and from 12 to 17, Malthusian drill 3 times a week, had made the taking of these precautions almost as automatic and inevitable as blinking. "Oh, and that reminds me," she said as she came back from the bathroom. "Fanny Crown wants to know where you found that lovely green Morocco surrogate cartridge belt you gave me." Alternate Thursdays were Bernard's solidarity service days. After an early dinner at the Aphroditeum, to which Helmholtz had recently been elected under Rule 2, he took leave of his friend and, hailing a taxi on the roof, told the man to fly to the Fordson Community Singery. The machine rose a couple of 100 meters, then headed eastwards, and as it turned, there before Bernard's eyes, gigantically beautiful, was the Singery. Floodlighted, its 320 meters of white Carrara surrogate gleamed with a snowy incandescence over Ludgate Hill. At each of the 4 corners of its helicopter platform, an immense T shone crimson against the night, and from the mouths of 24 vast golden trumpets rumbled a solemn synthetic music. "Damn, I'm late," Bernard said to himself, as he first caught sight of Big Henry, the Singery clock. And sure enough, as he was paying off his cab, Big Henry sounded the hour.
"Ford," sang out an immense bass voice from all the golden trumpets. "Ford! Ford! Ford!" 9 times.
Bernard ran for the lift. The great auditorium for Ford's Day celebration and other massed community sings was at the bottom of the building. Above it, 100 to each floor, were the 7,000 rooms used by solidarity groups for their fortnight services. Bernard dropped down to floor 33, hurried along the corridor, stood hesitating for a moment outside room 3,210, then, having wound himself up, opened the door and walked in. Thank Ford, he was not the last. 3 chairs of the 12, arranged round the circular table, were still unoccupied. He slipped into the nearest of them as inconspicuously as he could, and prepared to frown at the yet later comers whenever they should arrive. Turning towards him, "What were you playing this afternoon?" the girl on his left inquired. "Obstacle or electromagnetic?" Bernard looked at her, thought it was Morgana Rothschild, and blushingly had to admit that he had been playing neither. Morgana stared at him with astonishment. There was an awkward silence. Then, pointedly, she turned away and addressed herself to the more sporting man on her left. "A good beginning for a solidarity service," thought Bernard miserably, and foresaw for himself yet another failure to achieve atonement. If only he had given himself time to look round, instead of scuttling for the nearest chair. He could have sat between Fifi Bradlaugh and Joanna Diesel, instead of which he had gone and blindly planted himself next to Morgana. Morgana! Ford! Those black eyebrows of hers, that eyebrow, rather, for they met above the nose. Ford! And on his right was Clara Detterding,
True, Clara's eyebrows didn't meet, but she was really too pneumatic. Whereas Fifi and Joanna were absolutely right. Plump, blonde, not too large. And it was that great lout, Tom Kawaguchi, who now took the seat between them. The last arrival was Sarojini Engels.
"You're late," said the president of the group severely. "Don't let it happen again."
Sarojini apologized and slid into her place between Jim Bokanovsky and Herbert Bakunin. The group was now complete, the solidarity circle perfect and without flaw. Man, woman, man, in a ring of endless alternation round the table. 12 of them ready to be made one, waiting to come together, to be fused, to lose their 12 separate identities in a larger being. The president stood up, made the sign of the T, and switching on the synthetic music, let loose the soft, indefatigable beating of drums and a choir of instruments, near wind and superstring, that plangently repeated and repeated the brief and unescapably haunting melody of the first solidarity hymn. Again, again. And it was not the ear that heard the pulsing rhythm, it was the midriff, the wail and clang of those recurring harmonies haunted not the mind, but the yearning bowels of compassion. The president made another sign of the T and sat down. The service had begun. The dedicated soma tablets were placed in the center of the table. The loving cup of strawberry ice cream soma was passed from hand to hand, and with the formula, "I drink to my annihilation," 12 times quaffed. Then, to the accompaniment of the synthetic orchestra, the first solidarity hymn was sung. "Ford, we are 12. Oh, make us one, like drops within the social river. Oh, make us now together run, as swiftly as thy shining flivver." 12 yearning stanzas. And then the loving cup was passed a second time. "I drink to the greater being," was now the formula. All drank. Tirelessly the music played, the drums beat, the crying and clashing of the harmonies were an obsession in the melted bowels. The second solidarity hymn was sung. "Come, greater being, social friend, annihilating 12 in 1, we long to die, for when we end, our larger life has but begun." Again, 12 stanzas. By this time the soma had begun to work. Eyes shone, cheeks were flushed, the inner light of universal benevolence broke out on every face in happy, friendly smiles. Even Bernard felt himself a little melted. When Morgana Rothschild turned and beamed at him, he did his best to beam back. But the eyebrow, the black 2-in-1, alas, it was still there. He couldn't ignore it, couldn't, however hard he tried. The melting hadn't gone far enough. Perhaps if he had been sitting between Fifi and Joanna. For the third time, the loving cup went round.
"I drink to the imminence of his coming," said Morgana Rothschild, whose turn it happened to be to initiate the circular rite. Her tone was loud, exultant. She drank and passed the cup to Bernard. "I drink to the imminence of his coming," he repeated, with a sincere attempt to feel that the coming was imminent. But the eyebrow continued to haunt him, and the coming, so far as he was concerned, was horribly remote. He drank and handed the cup to Clara Detterding. "It'll be a failure again," he said to himself. "I know it will." But he went on doing his best to beam. The loving cup had made its circuit. Lifting his hand, the president gave a signal. The chorus broke out into the third solidarity hymn. "Feel how the greater being comes. Rejoice, and in rejoicings die. melt in the music of the drums, for I am you, and you are I.
As verse succeeded verse, the voices thrilled with an ever intenser excitement. The sense of the coming's imminence was like an electric tension in the air. The president switched off the music, and with the final note of the final stanza, there was absolute silence. The silence of stretched expectancy, quivering and creeping with a galvanic life. The president reached out his hand, and suddenly a voice, a deep, strong voice, more musical than any merely human voice, richer, warmer, more vibrant with love and yearning and compassion, a wonderful, mysterious, supernatural voice, spoke from above their heads, very slowly.
Oh, Ford! Ford! Ford!
It said diminishingly and on a descending scale. A sensation of warmth radiated thrillingly out from the solar plexus to every extremity of the bodies of those who listened. Tears came into their eyes. Their hearts, their bowels seemed to move within them as though with an independent life.
Ford!
They were melting. Ford! Dissolved! Dissolved! Then, in another tone, suddenly, startlingly, "Listen!" trumpeted the voice. "Listen!" They listened. After a pause, sunk to a whisper, but a whisper somehow more penetrating than the loudest cry.
"The feet of the greater being!"
It went on and repeated the words.
"The feet of the greater being."
The whisper almost expired.
"The feet of the greater being are on the stairs."
And once more there was silence, and the expectancy, momentarily relaxed, was stretched again, tauter, tauter, almost to the tearing point. The feet of the greater being. Oh, they heard them. They heard them coming softly down the stairs, coming nearer and nearer down the invisible stairs. The feet of the greater being. And suddenly the tearing point was reached. Her eyes staring, her lips parted, Morgana Rothschild sprang to her feet.
"I hear him!" she cried. "I hear him!"
"He's coming!" shouted Sarojini Engels.
"Yes, he's coming! I hear him!"
Fifi Bradlaugh and Tom Kawaguchi rose simultaneously to their feet.
"Oh, oh, oh!"
Joanna inarticulately testified.
"He's coming!"
yelled Jim Bokanovsky. The president leaned forward and with a touch released a delirium of cymbals and blown brass, a fever of tom-tomming.
"Oh, he's coming!"
screamed Clara Detterding.
"Ah!"
And it was as though she were having her throat cut. Feeling that it was time for him to do something, Bernard also jumped up and shouted,
"I hear him! He's coming!"
But it wasn't true. He heard nothing, and for him, nobody was coming. Nobody. In spite of the music, in spite of the mounting excitement. But he waved his arms, he shouted with the best of them, and when the others began to jig and stamp and shuffle, he also jigged and shuffled. Round they went, a circular procession of dancers, each with hands on the hips of the dancer preceding, round and round, shouting in unison, stamping to the rhythm of the music with their feet, beating it out with hands on the buttocks in front, 12 pairs of hands beating as one, 12 buttocks slabbily resounding, 12 as one, 12 as one. "I hear him! I hear him coming!" The music quickened, faster beat the feet, faster, faster fell the rhythmic hands, and all at once a great synthetic bass boomed out the words which announced the approaching atonement and final consummation of solidarity, the coming of the 12-in-1, the incarnation of the greater being. Orgy! Porgy, it sang, while the tom-toms continued to beat their feverish tattoo.
Orgy, porgy, Ford and fun, kiss the girls and make them one, boys at one with girls at peace. Orgy, porgy gives release.
Orgy, porgy, the dancers caught up the liturgical refrain. Orgy, porgy, Ford and fun, kiss the girls. And as they sang, the lights began slowly to fade, and at the same time to grow warmer, richer, redder, until at last they were dancing in the crimson twilight of an embryo store. Orgy, porgy! In their blood-coloured and fetal darkness, the dancers continued for a while to circulate, to beat, and beat out the indefatigable rhythm. Orgy, porgy! Then the circle wavered, broke, fell in partial disintegration on the ring of couches which surrounded, circle enclosing circle, the table and its planetary chairs. Orgy, porgy! Tenderly the deep voice crooned and cooed. In the red twilight, it was as though some enormous negro dove were hovering benevolently over the now prone or supine dancers. They were standing on the roof. Big Henry had just sung 11. The night was calm and warm.
"Wasn't it wonderful?" said Fifi Bradlaugh. "Wasn't it simply wonderful?"
She looked at Bernard with an expression of rapture, but of rapture in which there was no trace of agitation or excitement, for to be excited is still to be unsatisfied. Hers was the calm ecstasy of achieved consummation, the peace not of mere vacant satiety and nothingness, but of balanced life, of energies at rest and in equilibrium. A rich and living peace. For the Solidarity Service had given as well as taken, drawn off only to replenish. She was full. She was made perfect. She was still more than merely herself.
"Don't you think it was wonderful?"
she insisted, looking into Bernard's face with those supernaturally shining eyes.
"Yes, I thought it was wonderful,"
he lied and looked away. The sight of her transfigured face was at once an accusation and an ironical reminder of his own separateness. He was as miserably isolated now as he had been when the service began, more isolated by reason of his unreplenished emptiness, his dead satiety. Separate and unatoned, while the others were being fused into the greater being, alone even in Morgana's embrace, much more alone, indeed more hopelessly himself, than he had ever been in his life before. He had emerged from that crimson twilight into the common electric glare with a self-consciousness intensified to the pitch of agony. He was utterly miserable, and perhaps, her shining eyes accused him, perhaps it was his own fault.
"Quite wonderful," he repeated.
But the only thing he could think of was Morgana's eyebrow. Chapter 6
"Odd, odd, odd," was Leninger's verdict on Bernard Marx.
So odd, indeed, that in the course of the succeeding weeks she had wondered more than once whether she shouldn't change her mind about the New Mexico holiday and go instead to the North Pole with Benito Hoover. The trouble was that she knew the North Pole, had been there with George Edsel only last summer, and what was more, found it pretty grim. Nothing to do, and the hotel too hopelessly old-fashioned. No television laid on in the bedrooms, no scent organ, only the most putrid synthetic music, and not more than 25 escalator squash courts for over 200 guests. No, decidedly, she couldn't face the North Pole again. Added to which, she had only been to America once before, and even then how inadequately. A cheap weekend in New York
Had it been with Jean-Jacques Habibullah or Bokanovsky Jones? She couldn't remember. Anyhow, it was of absolutely no importance. The prospect of flying west again, and for a whole week, was very inviting. Moreover, for at least 3 days of that week, they would be in the Savage Reservation. Not more than half a dozen people in the whole center had ever been inside a Savage Reservation. As an Alpha Plus psychologist, Bernard was one of the few men she knew entitled to a permit. For Lenina, the opportunity was unique. And yet, so unique also was Bernard's oddness that she had hesitated to take it, had actually thought of risking the pole again with funny old Benito. At least Benito was normal, whereas Bernard... "Alcohol in his blood, surrogate," was Fanny's explanation of every eccentricity. But Henry, with whom one evening, when they were in bed together, Lenina had rather anxiously discussed her new lover, Henry had compared poor Bernard to a rhinoceros. "You can't teach a rhinoceros tricks," he had explained in his brief and vigorous style. "Some men are almost rhinoceroses. They don't respond properly to conditioning, poor devils. Bernard's one of them. Luckily for him, he's pretty good at his job. Otherwise, the director would never have kept him. However," he added consolingly, "I think he's pretty harmless." Pretty harmless, perhaps, but also pretty disquieting. That mania, to start with, for doing things in private, which meant, in practice, not doing anything at all. For what was there that one could do in private? Apart, of course, from going to bed. But one couldn't do that all the time. Yes, what was there? Precious little. The first afternoon they went out together was particularly fine. Lenina had suggested a swim at Torquay Country Club, followed by dinner at the Oxford Union. But Bernard thought that there would be too much of a crowd. Then what about a round of electromagnetic golf at St. Andrews? But again, no. Bernard considered that electromagnetic golf was a waste of time. "Then what's time for?" asked Lenina in some astonishment. Apparently for going walks in the Lake District. For that was what he now proposed. Land on the top of Skiddaw and walk for a couple of hours in the heather. "Alone with you, Lenina."
"But, Bernard, we shall be alone all night."
Bernard blushed and looked away. I meant alone for talking," he mumbled.
"Talking? But what about?"
Walking and talking, that seemed a very odd way of spending an afternoon. In the end, she persuaded him, much against his will, to fly over to Amsterdam to see the semi-demi-finals of the Women's Heavyweight Wrestling Championship.
"Oh, in a crowd," he grumbled, "as usual."
He remained obstinately gloomy the whole afternoon, wouldn't talk to Lenina's friends, of whom they met dozens in the ice cream soma bar between the wrestling bouts, and in spite of his misery, absolutely refused to take the half-gram raspberry sundae which she pressed upon him.
"I'd rather be myself," he said. "Myself and nasty, not somebody else, however jolly."
"A gram in time saves nine," said Lenina, producing a bright treasure of sleep-taught wisdom. Bernard pushed away the proffered glass impatiently.
"Now don't lose your temper," she said. "Remember, one cubic centimetre cures 10 gloomy sentiments."
"Oh, for Ford's sake, be quiet," he shouted.
Lenina shrugged her shoulders.
"A gram is always better than a dam," she concluded with dignity, and drank the sundae herself.
On their way back across the channel, Bernard insisted on stopping his propeller and hovering on his helicopter screws within 100 feet of the waves. The weather had taken a change for the worse. A southwesterly wind had sprung up. The sky was cloudy.
"Look," he commanded.
"But it's horrible," said Lenina, shrinking back from the window. She was appalled by the rushing emptiness of the night, by the black foam-flecked water heaving beneath them, by the pale face of the moon so haggard and distracted among the hastening clouds.
"Let's turn on the radio, quick."
She reached for the dialing knob on the dashboard and turned it at random.
"Skies are blue inside of you,"
sang 16 tremoloing falsettos.
"The weather's always..."
then a hiccup and silence. Bernard had switched off the current.
"I want to look at the sea in peace," he said. "One can't even look with that beastly noise going on."
"But it's lovely, and I don't want to look."
"But I do," he insisted. "It makes me feel as though..."
He hesitated, searching for words with which to express himself. "As though I were more of me, if you see what I mean. More on my own, not so completely a part of something else. Not just a cell in the social body. Doesn't it make you feel like that, Lenina?"
But Lenina was crying.
"It's horrible, it's horrible," she kept repeating. "And how can you talk like that about not wanting to be part of the social body? After all, everyone works for everyone else. We can't do without anyone, even Epsilons."
"Yes, I know," said Bernard derisively. "Even Epsilons are useful. So am I, and I damn well wish I weren't."
Lenina was shocked by his blasphemy. "Bernard," she protested in a voice of amazed distress, "how can you?" In a different key, "How can I?" he repeated meditatively. "No, the real problem is, how is it that I can't? Or rather, because after all I know quite well why I can't, what would it be like if I could, if I were free, not enslaved by my conditioning?"
"But, Bernard, you're saying the most awful things." "Don't you wish you were free, Lenina?"
"I don't know what you mean. I am free. Free to have the most wonderful time. Everybody's happy nowadays."
He laughed. "Yes, everybody's happy nowadays. We begin giving the children that at 5. But wouldn't you like to be free to be happy in some other way, Lenina? In your own way, for example, not in everybody else's way."
"I don't know what you mean," she repeated. Then, turning to him, "Oh, do let's go back, Bernard," she besought. "I do so hate it here."
"Don't you like being with me?"
"But of course, Bernard. It's this horrible place."
"I thought we'd be more together here, with nothing but the sea and moon. More together than in that crowd, or even in my rooms. Don't you understand that?"
"I don't understand anything," she said with decision, determined to preserve her incomprehension intact. "Nothing. Least of all," she continued in another tone, "why you don't take soma when you have these dreadful ideas of yours. You'd forget all about them, and instead of feeling miserable, you'd be jolly."
"So jolly," she repeated, and smiled, for all the puzzled anxiety in her eyes, with what was meant to be an inviting and voluptuous cajolery.
He looked at her in silence, his face unresponsive and very grave, looked at her intently. After a few seconds, Lenina's eyes flinched away. She uttered a nervous little laugh, tried to think of something to say, and couldn't. The silence prolonged itself. When Bernard spoke at last, it was in a small, tired voice.
"All right, then," he said. "We'll go back."
And stepping hard on the accelerator, he sent the machine rocketing up into the sky. At 4,000, he started his propeller. They flew in silence for a minute or two. Then suddenly, Bernard began to laugh. Rather oddly, Lenina thought, but still it was laughter.
"Feeling better?" she ventured to ask.
For answer, he lifted one hand from the controls, and slipping his arm round her, began to fondle her breasts.
"Thank Ford," she said to herself. "He's all right again."
Half an hour later, they were back in his rooms. Bernard swallowed 4 tablets of soma at a gulp, turned on the radio and television, and began to undress.
"Well?"
Lenina inquired with significant archness when they met next afternoon on the roof.
"Did you think it was fun yesterday?"
Bernard nodded. They climbed into the plane. A little jolt, and they were off.
"Everyone says I'm awfully pneumatic,"
said Lenina, reflectively, patting her own legs.
"Awfully."
But there was an expression of pain in Bernard's eyes. Like meat, he was thinking.
She looked up with a certain anxiety. But you don't think I'm too plump, do you? He shook his head. Like so much meat. You think I'm all right? Another nod. In every way?
Perfect, he said aloud, and inwardly, she thinks of herself that way. She doesn't mind being meat.
Lenina smiled triumphantly, but her satisfaction was premature.
All the same, he went on after a little pause, I still rather wish it had all ended differently.
Differently? Were there other endings?
I didn't want it to end with our going to bed, he specified.
Lenina was astonished.
Not at once, not the first day.
But then what? He began to talk a lot of incomprehensible and dangerous nonsense. Lenina did her best to stop the ears of her mind, but every now and then a phrase would insist on becoming audible.
To try the effect of arresting my impulses, she heard him say.
The word seemed to touch a spring in her mind. Never put off till tomorrow the fun you can have today, she said gravely.
200 repetitions twice a week from 14 to 16 and a half, was all his comment.
The mad, bad talk rambled on.
I want to know what passion is, she heard him saying. I want to feel something strongly.
When the individual feels, the community reels, Lenina pronounced.
Well, why shouldn't it reel a bit?
Bernard. But Bernard remained unabashed.
Adults, intellectually and during working hours, he went on, infants where feeling and desire are concerned.
Our Ford loved infants. Ignoring the interruption,
it suddenly struck me the other day, continued Bernard, that it might be possible to be an adult all the time.
I don't understand. Lenina's tone was firm.
I know you don't, and that's why we went to bed together yesterday, like infants, instead of being adults and waiting.
But it was fun, Lenina insisted, wasn't it?
Oh, the greatest fun, he answered,
but in a voice so mournful, with an expression so profoundly miserable, that Lenina felt all her triumph suddenly evaporate. Perhaps he had found her too plump after all.
I told you so,
was all that Fanny said when Lenina came and made her confidences.
It's the alcohol they put in his surrogate.
All the same, Lenina insisted, I do like him. He has such awfully nice hands, and the way he moves his shoulders, that's very attractive. She sighed. But I wish he weren't so odd. Halting for a moment outside the door of the director's room, Bernard drew a deep breath and squared his shoulders, bracing himself to meet the dislike and disapproval which he was certain of finding within. He knocked and entered.
"A permit for you to initial, director," he said as airily as possible, and laid the paper on the writing table.
The director glanced at him sourly. But the stamp of the World Controller's office was at the head of the paper, and the signature of Mustafa Mond, bold and black, across the bottom. Everything was perfectly in order. The director had no choice. He penciled his initials, two small pale letters, abject at the feet of Mustafa Mond, and was about to return the paper without a word of comment or genial Ford speed, when his eye was caught by something written in the body of the permit.
"For the New Mexican Reservation?"
he said, and his tone, the face he lifted to Bernard, expressed a kind of agitated astonishment. Surprised by his surprise, Bernard nodded. There was a silence. The director leaned back in his chair, frowning.
"How long ago was it?" he said, speaking more to himself than to Bernard. 20 years, I suppose, nearer 25. I must have been your age.
He sighed and shook his head. Bernard felt extremely uncomfortable. A man so conventional, so scrupulously correct as the director,
and to commit so gross a solecism. It made him want to hide his face, to run out of the room. Not that he himself saw anything intrinsically objectionable in people talking about the remote past. That was one of those hypnopedic prejudices he had, so he imagined, completely got rid of. What made him feel shy was the knowledge that the director disapproved. Disapproved, and yet had been betrayed into doing the forbidden thing. Under what inward compulsion? Through his discomfort, Bernard eagerly listened.
"I had the same idea as you," the director was saying. "Wanted to have a look at the savages. Got a permit for New Mexico and went there for my summer holiday. With a girl I was having at the moment, she was a beta minus, and I think," he shut his eyes, "I think she had yellow hair. Anyhow, she was pneumatic, particularly pneumatic. I remember that. Well, we went there, and we looked at the savages, and we rode about on horses and all that. And then, it was almost the last day of my leave, then, well, she got lost. We'd gone riding up one of those revolting mountains, and it was horribly hot and oppressive, and after lunch we went to sleep. Or at least I did. She must have gone for a walk, alone. At any rate, when I woke up, she wasn't there, and the most frightful thunderstorm I've ever seen was just bursting on us, and it poured and roared and flashed, and the horses broke loose and ran away, and I fell down trying to catch them and hurt my knee so I could hardly walk. Still, I searched and shouted and searched, but there was no sign of her. Then I thought she must have gone back to the rest house by herself, so I crawled down into the valley by the way we had come. My knee was agonizingly painful, and I'd lost my soma. It took me hours. I didn't get back to the rest house till after midnight. And she wasn't there. She wasn't there," the director repeated. There was a silence. "Well," he resumed at last, "the next day there was a search, but we couldn't find her. She must have fallen into a gully somewhere, or been eaten by a mountain lion. Ford knows. Anyhow, it was horrible. It upset me very much at the time, more than it ought to have done, I dare say. Because, after all, it's the sort of accident that might have happened to anyone. And, of course, the social body persists, although the component cells may change."
But this sleep-talk consolation did not seem to be very effective. Shaking his head, "I actually dream about it sometimes," the director went on in a low voice. "Dream of being woken up by that peal of thunder and finding her gone. Dream of searching and searching for her under the trees." He lapsed into the silence of reminiscence.
"You must have had a terrible shock," said Bernard, almost enviously.
At the sound of his voice, the director started into a guilty realization of where he was, shot a glance at Bernard, and averted his eyes, blushed darkly, looked at him again with sudden suspicion, and angrily, on his dignity, "Don't imagine," he said, "that I'd had any indecorous relation with the girl. Nothing emotional, nothing long-drawn. It was all perfectly healthy and normal." He handed Bernard the permit. "I really don't know why I bored you with this trivial anecdote." Furious with himself for having given away a discreditable secret, he vented his rage on Bernard. The look in his eyes was now frankly malignant.
"And I should like to take this opportunity, Mr. Marks," he went on, "of saying that I'm not at all pleased with the reports I receive of your behavior outside working hours. You may say that this is not my business, but it is. I have the good name of the center to think of. My workers must be above suspicion, particularly those of the highest castes. Alphas are so conditioned that they do not have to be infantile in their emotional behavior, but that is all the more reason for their making a special effort to conform. It is their duty to be infantile, even against their inclination. And so, Mr. Marks, I give you fair warning."
The director's voice vibrated with an indignation that had now become wholly righteous and impersonal, was the expression of the disapproval of society itself.
If ever I hear again of any lapse from a proper standard of infantile decorum, I shall ask for your transference to a sub-centre, preferably to Iceland. Good morning."
And swivelling round in his chair, he picked up his pen and began to write.
"That'll teach him,"
he said to himself. But he was mistaken, for Bernard left the room with a swagger, exulting as he banged the door behind him in the thought that he stood alone, embattled against the order of things, elated by the intoxicating consciousness of his individual significance and importance. Even the thought of persecution left him undismayed, was rather tonic than depressing. He felt strong enough to meet and overcome affliction, strong enough to face even Iceland. And this confidence was the greater for his not for a moment really believing that he would be called upon to face anything at all. People simply weren't transferred for things like that. Iceland was just a threat, a most stimulating and life-giving threat. Walking along the corridor, he actually whistled. Heroic was the account he gave that evening of his interview with the DHC. "Whereupon," it concluded, "I simply told him to go to the bottomless past and marched out of the room, and that was that." He looked at Helmholtz Watson expectantly, awaiting his due reward of sympathy, encouragement, admiration. But no word came. Helmholtz sat silent, staring at the floor. He liked Bernard. He was grateful to him for being the only man of his acquaintance with whom he could talk about the subjects he felt to be important. Nevertheless, there were things in Bernard which he hated. This boasting, for example, and the outbursts of an abject self-pity with which it alternated, and his deplorable habit of being bold after the event, and full, in absence, of the most extraordinary presence of mind. He hated these things just because he liked Bernard. The seconds passed. Helmholtz continued to stare at the floor. And suddenly Bernard blushed and turned away. The journey was quite uneventful. The Blue Pacific rocket was 2.5 minutes early at New Orleans, lost 4 minutes in a tornado over Texas, but flew into a favorable air current at longitude 95 west, and was able to land at Santa Fe less than 40 seconds behind schedule time. 40 seconds on a 6.5-hour flight, not so bad, Lenina conceded. They slept that night at Santa Fe. The hotel was excellent, incomparably better, for example, than that horrible Aurora Bora palace in which Lenina had suffered so much the previous summer. Liquid air, television, vibro vacuum massage, radio, boiling caffeine solution, hot contraceptives, and 8 different kinds of scent were laid on in every bedroom. The synthetic music plant was working as they entered the hall and left nothing to be desired. A notice in the lift announced that there were 60 escalator squash racket courts in the hotel, and that obstacle and electromagnetic golf could both be played in the park. "But it sounds simply too lovely," cried Lenina. "I almost wish we could stay here. 60 escalator squash courts."
"There won't be any in the reservation," Bernard warned her. "And no scent, no television, no hot water even. If you feel you can't stand it, stay here till I come back."
Lenina was quite offended. "Of course I can stand it. I only said it was lovely here because, well, because progress is lovely, isn't it?"
500 repetitions once a week from 13 to 17, said Bernard wearily, as though to himself.
"What did you say?"
"I said that progress was lovely. That's why you mustn't come to the reservation unless you really want to."
"But I do want to."
"Very well, then," said Bernard,
and it was almost a threat. Their permit required the signature of the warden of the reservation, at whose office next morning they duly presented themselves. An Epsilon Plus Negro porter took in Bernard's card, and they were admitted almost immediately. The warden was a blonde and brachycephalic Alpha Minus, short, red, moon-faced, and broad-shouldered, with a loud, booming voice, very well adapted to the utterance of hypnopedic wisdom. He was a mine of irrelevant information and unasked-for good advice. Once started, he went on and on, boomingly.
560,000 square kilometers, divided into four distinct sub-reservations, each surrounded by a high-tension wire.